a man haunted by a vision of hell on earth. A searing social critic, Mr. Huxley, 27 years ago, wrote Brave New World, a novel that predicted that someday the entire world would live under a frightful dictatorship. Today, Mr. Huxley says that his fictional world of horror is probably just around the corner for all of us. We'll find out why in a moment.
The Mike Wallace Interview, presented by the American Broadcasting Company in association with the Fund for the Republic, brings you a special television series discussing the problems of survival and freedom in America.
Good evening, I'm Mike Wallace. Tonight's guest, Aldous Huxley, is a man of letters, as disturbing as he is distinguished. Born in England, now a resident of California, Mr. Huxley has written some of the most electric novels and social criticism of this century. He's just finished a series of essays called Enemies of Freedom, in which he outlines and defines some of the threats to our freedom in the United States. And Mr. Huxley, right off the bat, let me ask you this, as you see it, who and what are the enemies of freedom here in the United States?
Well, I don't think you can say who in the United States. I don't think there are any sinister persons deliberately trying to rob people of their freedom. But I do think, first of all, that there are a number of impersonal forces which are pushing in the direction of less and less freedom. And I also think that there are a number of technological devices which anybody who wishes to use can use to accelerate this process of going away from freedom, of imposing control.
Well, what are these forces and these devices, Mr. Huxley?
I should say that there are two main impersonal forces. The first of them is not exceedingly important in the United States at the present time, though very important in other countries. This is the force which in general terms can be called overpopulation, the mounting pressure of population pressing upon existing resources. This, of course, is an extraordinary thing. Something is happening which has never happened in the world's history before. I mean, let's just take a simple fact that between the time of the birth of Christ and the landing of the Mayflower, the population of the earth doubled. It rose from 250 million to probably 500 million. Today, the population of the earth is rising at such a rate that it will double in half a century.
Well, why should overpopulation work to diminish our freedoms?
Well, in a number of ways. I mean, the experts in the field, like Harrison Brown, for example, pointed out that in the underdeveloped countries, actually the standard of living is at present falling, that people have less to eat and less goods per capita than they had 50 years ago. And as the position of these countries, the economic position, becomes more and more precarious, obviously the central government has to take over more and more responsibility for keeping the ship of state on an even keel. And then, of course, you're likely to get social unrest under such conditions, with again an intervention of the central government. So I think one sees here a pattern which seems to be pushing very strongly towards a totalitarian regime. And unfortunately, as in all these underdeveloped countries, the only highly organized political party is the Communist Party, it looks rather as though they will be the heirs to this unfortunate process, that they will step into the power, position of power.
Well, then, ironically enough, one of the greatest forces against communism in the world, the Catholic Church, according to your thesis, would seem to be pushing us directly into the hands of the communists because they are against birth control.
Well, I think this strange paradox probably is true. There is an extraordinary situation, actually. I mean, one has to look at it, of course, from a biological point of view. The whole essence of biological life on Earth is a question of balance, and what we have done is to practice death control in a most intensive manner without balancing this with birth control at the other end. Consequently, the birth rates remain as high as they were, and death rates have fallen substantially.
All right, then. So much for the time being, anyway, for overpopulation. Another force that is diminishing our freedoms.
Well, another force which I think is very strongly operative in this country is the force of what may be called over-organization. As technology becomes more and more complicated, it becomes necessary to have more and more elaborate organizations, more hierarchical organizations. And incidentally, the advance of technology has been accompanied by an advance in the science of organization. It's now possible to make organizations on a larger scale than was ever possible before. And so that you have more and more people living their lives out as subordinates in these hierarchical systems controlled by bureaucracies, either the bureaucracies of big business or the bureaucracies of big government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the devices that you were talking about, are there specific devices or methods of communication which diminish our freedoms in addition to overpopulation and over-organization?
Well, there are certainly devices which can be used in this way. I mean, let us take, after all, a piece of very recent and very painful history is the propaganda used by Hitler, which was incredibly effective. I mean, what were Hitler's methods? Hitler used terror on the one kind, brute force on the one hand, but he also used a very efficient form of propaganda, which he was using every modern device at that time. He didn't have TV, but he had the radio, which he used to the fullest extent, and was able to impose his will on an immense mass of people. I mean, the Germans were a highly educated people.
Well, we're aware of all this, but how do you equate Hitler's use of propaganda with the way that propaganda, if you will, is used, let us say, here in the United States? Are you suggesting that there is a parallel?
Needless to say, it's not being used in this way now. But the point is, it seems to me, that there are methods at present available, methods superior in some respects to Hitler's method, which could be used in a bad situation. I mean, what I feel very strongly is that we mustn't be caught by surprise by our own advancing technology. This has happened again and again in history. Technology has advanced, and this changes social conditions. And suddenly people have found themselves in a situation which they didn't foresee and doing all sorts of things they didn't really want to do.
Well, now, what do you mean? Do you mean that we develop our television but we don't know how to use it correctly? Is that the point that you're making?
Well, at present the television, I think, is being used quite harmlessly. It's being used, I think, I would feel it's being used too much to distract everybody all the time. But, I mean, imagine, which must be the situation in all communist countries, where the television, where it exists, is always saying the same thing the whole time, is always driving along. It's not creating a wide front of distraction, it's creating a one-pointed drumming in of a single idea all the time. It's obviously an immensely powerful instrument.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about the potential misuse of the instrument.
Exactly. We have, after all technology is in itself morally neutral. These are just powers which can either be used well or ill. It's the same thing with atomic energy. We can either use it to blow ourselves up, or we can use it as a substitute for the coal and the oil which are running out.
You've even written about the use of drugs in this light.
Well, now, this is a very interesting subject. I mean, in this book that you mentioned, this book of mine, Brave New World, I postulated a substance called Soma, which was a very versatile drug. It would make people feel happy in small doses, it would make them see visions in medium doses, and it would send them to sleep in large doses. Well, I don't think such a drug exists now, nor do I think it will ever exist, but we do have drugs which will do some of these things, and I think it's quite on the cards that we may have drugs which will profoundly change our mental states without doing us any harm. I mean, this is the pharmacological revolution which has taken place, that we have now powerful mind-changing drugs which, physiologically speaking, are almost costless. I mean, they are not like opium or like cocaine, which do change the state of mind, but leave terrible results physiologically and morally.
Mr. Huxley, in your new essays, you state that these various enemies of freedom, are pushing us toward a real-life, brave new world, and you say that it's awaiting us just around the corner. First of all, can you detail for us what life in this brave new world, which you fear so much, what life might be like?
Well, to start with, I think this kind of the dictatorship of the future, I think will be very unlike the dictatorships which we've been familiar with in the immediate past. I mean, take another book prophesying the future, which was a very remarkable book, George Orwell's 1984. Mm-hmm. Well, this book was written at the height of the Stalinist regime and just after the Hitler regime. And there he foresaw a dictatorship using entirely the methods of terror, the methods of physical violence. Now, I think what is going to happen in the future is the dictators will find, as the old saying goes, that you can do everything with bayonets except sit on them. But if you want to preserve your power indefinitely, you have to get the consent of the ruled. And this they will do partly by drugs, as I foresaw in Brave New World, partly by these new techniques of propaganda. They will do it by bypassing the sort of rational side of man and appealing to his subconscious and his deeper emotions, and his physiology even, and so making him actually love his slavery. I mean, I think this is the danger, that actually people may be in some ways happy under the new regime, but they will be happy in a situation where they oughtn't to be happy.
But let me ask you this. You're talking about a world that could take place within the confines of a totalitarian state. Mm. Let's become more immediate, more urgent about it. We believe, anyway, that we live in a democracy here in the United States. Do you believe that this brave new world that you talk about could, let's say, in the next quarter century, the next century, could come here to our shores?
I think it could. I mean, that's why I feel it's so extremely important here and now to start thinking about these problems, not to let ourselves be taken by surprise by the new advances in technology. I mean, for example, in regard to the use of the drugs, we know there's enough evidence now for us to be able, on the basis of this evidence and using a certain amount of creative imagination, to foresee the kind of uses which could be made in by people of bad will with these things, and to attempt to forestall this. And in the same way, I think, with these other methods of propaganda, we can foresee and we can do a good deal to forestall. I mean, after all, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance.
You write in Enemies of Freedom, you write specifically about the United States. You say this, writing about American political campaigns. You say, all that is needed is money and a candidate who can be coached to look sincere. Political principles and plans for specific action have come to lose most of their importance. The personality of the candidate, the way he is projected by the advertising experts, are the things that really matter.
Well, this is, during the last campaign, there was a great deal of this kind of statement by the advertising managers of the campaign parties, this idea that the candidates had to be merchandised as though they were soap or toothpaste, and that you had to depend entirely on the personality. I mean, the personality is important, but there are certainly people with an extremely amiable personality, particularly on TV, who might not necessarily be very good in positions of political trust.
Well, do you feel that men like Eisenhower, Stevenson, Nixon, with knowledge of forethought, were trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the American public?
No, but they were being advised by powerful advertising agencies who were making campaigns of a quite different kind from what had been made before. And I think we shall see probably all kinds of new devices coming into the picture. I mean, for example, this thing which got a good deal of publicity last autumn, a subliminal projection. I mean, as it stands, this thing, I think, is of no menace to us at the moment. But I was talking the other day to one of the people who has done most experimental work in the psychological laboratory with this, was saying precisely this, that it is not at the moment a danger, but once you've established a principle that something works, you can be absolutely sure that the technology of it is going to improve steadily. And I mean, his view of the subject was that, well, maybe they will use it to some extent in the 1960 campaign, but they will probably use it a good deal and much more effectively in the 1964 campaign, because this is the kind of rate at which technology advances.
And we'll be persuaded to vote for a candidate that we do not know that we are being persuaded to vote
for. Exactly. I mean, this is a rather alarming feature, that you're being persuaded below the level of choice and reason.
In regard to advertising, which you mentioned just a little ago, in your writing, particularly in Enemies of Freedom, you attack Madison Avenue, which controls most of our television and radio advertising, newspaper advertising, and so forth. Why do you consistently attack the advertising agency?
Well, no, I think that advertisement plays a very necessary role, but the danger, it seems to me, in a democracy is this. I mean, what does a democracy depend on? A democracy depends on the individual voter making an intelligent and rational choice for what he regards as his enlightened self-interest in any given circumstance. But what these people are doing, I mean, what both for their particular purposes, for selling goods, and the dictatorial propagandists are doing, is to try to bypass the rational side of man and to appeal directly to these unconscious forces below the surface, so that you are, in a way, making nonsense of the whole democratic procedure, which is based on conscious choice on rational grounds.
Of course, well, maybe you have just answered this next question, because in your essay, you write about television commercials, not just political commercials, but television commercials as such. And how, as you put it, today's children walk around singing beer commercials and toothpaste commercials. And then you link this phenomenon in some way with the dangers of a dictatorship. Now, could you spell out the connection, or how do you feel that you have done so sufficiently?
Well, I mean, here, Kate, this whole question of children, I think, is a terribly important one, because children are quite clearly much more suggestible than the average grown-up. And again, suppose that that for one reason or another, all the propaganda was in the hands of one or very few agencies, you would have an extraordinarily powerful force playing on these children, who after all are going to grow up and be adults quite soon. I do think that this is not an immediate threat, but it remains a possible threat. And
you said something to the effect in your essay that the children of Europe used to be called cannon fodder, and here in the United States they are television and radio fodder.
Well, after all, you can read in the trade journals the most lyrical accounts of how necessary it is to get hold of the children, because then they will be loyal brand buyers later on.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, again, you just translate this into political terms. The dictator says they will be loyal ideology buyers when they're grown up.
We hear so much about brainwashing as used by the communists. Do you see any brainwashing other than that which we've just been talking about that is used here in the United States? Other forms of brainwashing?
Not in the form that has been used in China and in Russia, because this is essentially the application of propaganda methods, the most violent kind, to individuals. It's not a shotgun method like the advertising method. It's a way of getting hold of the person and playing both on his physiology and his psychology till he really breaks down, and then you can implant a new idea in his head. I mean, the descriptions of the methods are really blood-curdling when you read them, and not only the methods applied to political prisoners, but the methods applied, for example, to the training of the young communist administrators and missionaries. They receive an incredibly tough kind of training, which causes about 25% of them to break down or commit suicide, but produces 75% of completely one-pointed fanatics.
The question, of course, that keeps coming back to my mind is this. Obviously, politics in themselves are not evil. Television is not in itself evil. Atomic energy is not evil. And yet you seem to fear that it will be used in an evil way. Why is it that the right people will not, in your estimation, use them why is it that the wrong people will use these various devices and for the wrong motives?
Well, I think one of the reasons is that these are all instruments for obtaining power, and obviously the passion for power is one of the most moving passions that exist in man, and after all, this is all democracies are based on the proposition that power is very dangerous and that it's extremely important not to let any one man or any one small group have too much power for too long a time. After all, what are the British and American constitutions except devices for limiting power? And all these new devices are extremely efficient instruments for the imposition of power by small groups over larger masses.
Well, you ask this question yourself in Enemies of Freedom. I'll put your own question back to you. You ask this: in an age of accelerating overpopulation, of accelerating overorganization, and ever more efficient means of mass communication, how can we preserve the integrity and reassert the value of the human individual? You put the question. Now here's your chance to answer it, Mr. Huxley.
Well, this is obviously, first of all, it's a question of education. I think it's terribly important to insist on individual values. I mean, what is... there is a tendency, as you probably read a book by White, The Organization Man, a very interesting, valuable book, I think, where he speaks about the new type of group morality, group ethic, which speaks about the group as though the group were somehow more important than the individual. But this seems, as far as I'm concerned, to be in contradiction with what we know about the genetical makeup of human beings, that every human being is unique. And it is, of course, on this genetical basis that the whole idea of the value of freedom is based. And I think it's extremely important for us to stress this in all our educational life. And I would say it's also very important to teach people to be on their guard against the sort of verbal booby traps into which they're always being led, to analyze the kind of things that are said to them. Well, I think there is this whole educational side, and I think there are many more things that one could do to strengthen people and to make them more aware of what was being done.
You're a prophet of decentralization.
Well, yes, if this is feasible. It's one of the tragedies, it seems to me. I mean, many people have been talking about the importance of decentralization in order to give back to the voter a sense of direct power. I mean, the voter in an enormous electorate feels quite impotent and his vote seems to count for nothing. This is not true where the electorate is small and where he is dealing with a group which he can manage and understand. And if one can, as Jefferson, after all, suggested, break up the units into smaller and smaller units and so get a real self-governing democracy.
Well, that was all very well in Jefferson's day, but how can we revamp our economic system and decentralize and at the same time meet militarily and economically the tough challenge of a country like Soviet Russia?
Well, I think the answer to that is that there are, it seems to me that the production, industrial production, is of two kinds. I mean, there are some kinds of industrial production which obviously need the most tremendously high centralization, like the making of automobiles, for example. But there are many other kinds where you could decentralize quite easily and probably quite economically, and that you would then have this kind of decentralized life. After all, you begin to see it now if you travel through the South, this decentralized textile industry which is springing up there.
Mr. Huxley, let me ask you this, quite seriously. Is freedom necessary?
As far as I'm concerned, it is, yes.
Why? Is it necessary for a productive society?
Yes, I should say it is. I mean, a genuinely productive society. I mean, I think you could produce plenty of goods without much freedom. But I think the whole sort of creative life of man is ultimately impossible without a considerable measure of individual freedom, of that initiative, creation, all these things which we value, and I think value properly, are impossible without a large measure of freedom.
Well, Mr. Huxley, take a look again at the country which is in the stance of our opponent anyway it would seem to be there, Soviet Russia. It is strong and getting stronger economically, militarily. At the same time, it's developing its art forms pretty well. It seems not unnecessarily to squelch the creative urge among its people, and yet it is not a free society.
It's not a free society, but here is something very interesting, that those members of the society, like the scientists who are doing the creative work, are given far more freedom than anybody else. I mean, it's a privileged aristocratic society in which, provided that they don't poke their noses into political affairs, these people are given a great deal of prestige, a considerable amount of freedom, and a lot of money. I mean, this is a very interesting fact about the new Soviet regime. And I think what we're going to see is a people on the whole with very little freedom, but with an oligarchy on top enjoying a considerable measure of freedom and a very high standard of living.
And the people down below, the epsilons down below,
enjoying very little.
And you think that that kind of situation can long endure?
I think it can certainly endure much longer than a situation in which everybody is kept down. Because, I mean, they can certainly get their technological and scientific results on such a basis.
Well, the next time that I talk to you then, perhaps we should investigate further the possibility of the establishment of that kind of a society, where the drones work for the queen bees up above.
Well, but yes, but I must say I still believe in democracy. If we can make the best of the creative activities of the people on top plus those of the people on the bottom, so much the better.
Mr. Huxley, I surely thank you for spending this half hour with us, and I wish you Godspeed, sir.
Thank you.
Aldous Huxley finds himself these days in a peculiar and disturbing position. A quarter of a century after prophesying an authoritarian state in which people were reduced to ciphers, he can point at Soviet Russia and say, "I told you so." The crucial question, as he sees it now, is whether the so-called free world is shortly going to give Mr. Huxley the further dubious satisfaction of saying the same thing about us. Stay tuned for a preview of next week's interview. Till then, Mike Wallace, good night.
The following program was broadcast on Wednesday evening, May 3rd, 1961, by television station WTTW Channel 9, Chicago's educational television station. The program was Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Science Reporter, and the subject was Aldous Huxley on Image and Reality.
From the French window, I walked out under a kind of arbor covered in part by a climbing rose tree, in part by laths 1 inch wide with a half an inch of space between them. The sun was shining and the shadows of the laths made a zebra-like pattern on the ground and across the seat and back of the garden chair, which was standing at this end of the arbor. That chair, shall I ever forget it? Where the shadows fell on the canvas upholstery, stripes of a deep but glowing indigo alternated with stripes of an incandescent so intensely bright that it was hard to believe that they could be made of anything else but blue fire. For what seemed an immensely long time, I gazed without knowing, even without wishing to know what it was that confronted me. At any other time, I would have seen a chair barred with alternate light and shade. Today, the precept had swallowed up the concept. I was so completely absorbed in looking, so thunderstruck by what I actually saw, that I could not be aware of anything else. It was inexpressibly wonderful. Wonderful to the point almost of being terrifying. And suddenly, I had an inkling of what it must feel like to be mad.
Description from The Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley, who is at MIT this term as Carnegie Visiting Professor of Humanities. Mr. Huxley, going into a garden and seeing a chair under an arbor is a very ordinary kind of experience for most people. Why was this so intense and so vivid for you?
Well, it happened in the course of an experiment which I was doing at that time with a doctor friend of mine. An experiment with the drug mescaline, which immensely enhances the intensity of all visual impressions. And this was what happened, that this chair with these stripes of light and shadow upon it seemed, as I say, as I try to explain in this passage, seemed, one can only use the word supernatural in their intensity.
Is this the kind of experience which is only accessible through the use of a drug?
I think in this degree of intensity it probably is. But this whole problem of perception is one which has interested me a great deal in recent years. We know now from the study of perception that actually what we see, what we perceive, isn't just passively received by us, that we impose upon the external world patterns which have been formed in our mind through this sort of concept system we have. We have the system of labels and categories and names. And that what we see is in some sort a kind of illustration, a concrete illustration of the abstractions inside our heads. And now, the remarkable fact about mescaline is that in some way we bypass this verbal side of our mind, and we tend to see the external world almost as it is in itself, as it comes to us directly, without immediately imposing names and labels upon it. I mean, this was the reason why this chair for me was not a chair, because I didn't immediately, when I saw it, I didn't immediately say, this is a chair and these are the stripes of light and color, light and shadow on it. I just saw the thing in itself, and it was so extraordinary. Now, the significance of all this can be understood, I think, better as regards to a normal state of mind. If we look at paintings, for example, like those of Van Gogh, well, it's quite clear if you look at Van Gogh's paintings that he saw the world with a degree of intensity which most of us never see the world with at all. He was seeing it almost, I would say, as people who have taken mescaline see it. He was seeing not the concrete illustrations of an abstraction in his head, but, so to say, the thing in itself. The immediate impression was coming to him raw, without his imposing upon it any a structure from within the sort of conventional mold inside his skull. Now, this to me is something of great interest. I mean, can we, so to say, make the best of both worlds? Can we make the best of the world of concepts, the world of words and of ideas which we have and which, after all, are the basis of all civilized life? And at the same time, can we make the best of this sort of pure aesthetic emotion, pure aesthetic sensation of seeing the thing as it is in itself? This is something which interests me very much indeed.
And this is the great difficulty, then, trying to see what it really is, see the reality of it.
Well, seeing this aspect of reality, because I mean we live in a human world, and the human world always must contain these conceptual elements in it. I mean, this is why it's a human world, because it is a world which we fit automatically into our pattern of conceptions. But there are degrees in this, and I think it would be extremely valuable for all of us if at any rate, sometimes we could see the world as Van Gogh saw it, or even to some, almost as the Mescaline taker sees it. That is to say, with the kind of extraordinary intensity which comes when we don't see it through the spectacles of our concept system.
In the passage that we heard from your book and in your discussion of Van Gogh, this has been almost entirely a visual effect that we've been talking about. Does the same thing hold true, say, for the sense of taste or for what the ear can hear? Is this able to be magnified, to be intensified in the same way that the color can be?
In the case of, say, of mescaline, I don't know. I think people who do experience the world mainly in musical terms probably do get the same kind of intensification. In general, I think for most people, the music is very, very important when heard under the influence of mescaline, but there isn't the same kind of transfiguration of the individual tones into a higher degree of intensity. What there is this curious sense that time has ceased, and that although the tempo of the music has not changed, the music itself is developing in a kind of timeless world. It's as though we had passed from time into eternity, and it becomes possible in this condition to understand what some of the ancient philosophers meant when they spoke about eternity. For example, there's a Latin phrase to describe eternity which calls it a nunc stans, a standing now. And you get this definitely, this impression. You feel that the music is a standing now, that it's changing all the time, but changing not in a dimension of seconds and minutes, but changing, so to speak, in another kind of dimension, in a dimension of reality, a dimension of intensity, a dimension of beauty, so that there is a remarkable change in regard to music, certainly, with mescaline, but of a rather different kind from the change which takes place in regard to visual events.
And yet this is a pharmaceutical solution to the problem, isn't it, of trying to experience this intensity?
And of course it would, I think for ordinary purposes, this is, so to say, going too far. This is too much of a good thing. It has a degree of intensity which is quite terrifying. And it's very significant to see in the biography of Van Gogh that, and in his pictures, one can see that he was seeing the outside world with an intensity so tremendous that sometimes it was, as I hinted in this passage in The Doors of Perception, absolutely terrifying. And after all, Van Gogh ended as a suicide. And when one sees his last three pictures, which I did the other day at an excellent loan exhibition I was in Los Angeles, I was looking at, you can understand why he committed suicide, because the world was looking so fearful in its intensity. It was a kind of negative intensity, but no wonder the poor man had to could blow his brains out. But I don't think, to start with, this is the result of a drug, but I think without any doubt that a great deal can be done to help us to make the best of both worlds, to help us to make the best of the verbal world, and also of this world of immediate experience. I think there are psychological methods for producing this.
Well, why aren't we able to see this way? Not perhaps with the same intensity as Van Gogh, but at least part way to that intensity.
Well, this is a very interesting problem. I don't know if you remember the great poem of Wordsworth, ode on the intimations of immortality in childhood, what Wordsworth describes there is the kind of transfigured world in which he lived as a child, where everything had what he calls the glory and the freshness of a dream. And as he grew up into boyhood, he lost this, and the world faded into the light of common day. Now, I suspect very much that this isn't an isolated phenomenon. I think probably a great many children see the world in this transfigured way. They see a world which is much more like what we imagine the Garden of Eden to have been like. And that as they progress in their analytical education, their verbal and conceptual education, this is somehow gradually flattened out, that they tend to see things not as they are in themselves, not as direct experiences, but always through the spectacles of their conceptual system. I mean, they see things, as I put it before, as concrete illustrations of the abstractions which they've learned. And I think this is one of the reasons why, for most adults, the world is, in a sense, as dull as it seems to be. A few specially gifted people, I mean, like Van Gogh, obviously, like Monet, like many of the great artists, continue to see the world with this extraordinary freshness and brightness and intensity. But most of us go through the process which is described by Wordsworth and lose this impression of the world filled with the brightness and the freshness of a dream and see it as something rather drab and boring even. I think this is probably the main reason why we don't see as Van Gogh saw.
And it's in a case like Van Gogh where we can see almost the end product of this ability to perceive that here is almost the equivalent to the masculine state.
Yes, he of course, I mean, poor man, he was mentally unbalanced, and he sort of was pushed over the edge by this. He was not under control. He was, I mean, I think in a case like that, and in the case of somebody who is temporarily under the influence of masculine, he is not in a position to move back and forth at will from one world to the other. I mean, it seems to me that the really desirable state to be in is one in which we can at will pass from the humanly normal world of concepts into the world of immediate experience, to pass from this world where we attach a name and a label and a category to everything into this other world where a chair with stripes of light and darkness on it seems to be some sort of miraculous and supernatural object. I mean, not to the extent of which you get under mescaline, but to a considerable extent, so that you get this freshness and brightness, and at the same time, when you want to, you can think about the world in a perfectly rational way in terms of your concept system.
And the child then can see to a certain extent perhaps the way Van Gogh could, and yet he can deal with this. He can...
Yes, I mean, that the normal child, I mean, does find the other thing quite easy to move back and forth between the two. And then, of course, in the case of the child, I mean, you only have to look at children's art. Although he probably sees the world with this Monet-like or Van Gogh-like intensity, he does not possess the ability to render this. I mean, when he draws a picture, he always draws a picture which is purely symbolic. I mean, it's a kind of Neolithic art, so to speak, which is an art of patterns and of symbols, and not an impressionist art, because he just doesn't have the capacity to render this in any way. So that one sees that his mind is working quite easily in both worlds at once, in the symbolic world of his drawings and in the intensely vivid world of his immediate perceptions.
So then this is an ability which is at least originally in all of us, and then as we are educated in the conceptual idea, we begin to lose.
Yes, well, I don't know whether it's in all of us, but I suspect that it's in a great many of us, let us say, and that that the Wordsworthian picture in the Ode on the Intimations of Immortality is probably a very good psychological description of what many people go through.
And yet, isn't there perhaps something of just getting used to reality? If I go to a foreign city I've never been in for the first few days or weeks, it is very vivid and intense. The sounds and the sights or smells are altogether new and different. And yet, after a while, I can walk through the streets and not be aware of the city as I originally was. Does the child perhaps have that kind of experience too?
Yes, I think he does. I mean, after all, we say that familiarity breeds contempt. Not necessarily contempt, but it breeds indifference. But isn't this a very undesirable thing? I mean, wouldn't it be much better if we all of us could, by suitable psychological exercises, retain some of that freshness and wonder which we get when we go to a new city? I mean, it is really very unfortunate that because we take the same walk along the same streets every day, that the streets seem so dull and uninteresting, whereas actually each day the effects of light are a little different, the moisture on the pavement is different, and so on. And that if we had the impressionist's eye in this matter, we should be continually seeing something new and brilliant. I mean, for example, there's a delightful story about Cézanne. Somebody asked him, "Don't you get very bored with painting this same mountain, this Mont Sainte-Victoire, almost every day of the week?" He said, "Why should I get bored? I only have to change the position of my easel 8 feet to get an entirely different view." And how wonderful this is, that a man can find the view of a single mountain absolutely inexhaustible simply by moving a couple of paces away. And he again obviously had this intensity of vision.
Well, you mentioned the possibility of exercises to do this. What kind of exercises could there be that would help us to train and develop this function or this ability?
Well, I can imagine various kinds of exercise. I've actually seen this at work. My wife, who is a lay therapist, often uses this kind of exercise with neurotic patients, of getting them to look at a flower. I mean, if you can look at a flower in two ways, you see. You can look at it in the conceptual, scientific way. You look at the flower, and you say it has so many petals, it has so many stamens, etc.
Such as the chrysanthemum.
Yes, I don't know how many petals that has. It has an awful lot. But I mean, anyhow, you can examine it in this scientific way and attach labels to every part of it and analyze it and even make a scientific drawing of it, indicating what all the parts of the thing are. And then you can make the best of both worlds by passing from this scientific view of the flower to what may be called the aesthetic view. You can let the vision of the flower come to you in a completely passive and receptive way, so that you're not looking at it as illustrating a series of botanical abstractions, but simply as a beautiful object in itself. And I think exercises like this can be extraordinarily helpful. They can be extraordinarily helpful in regard to neurosis, for example, simply by getting people back into the present here and now, which is when most neurotic people are living somewhere else. And this is very valuable in that respect. But I think it can be extremely valuable for everybody by helping them to live in these two worlds at once. I mean, not at once, but I mean to be able to pass at will from one to the other, to look at the object analytically and conceptually, and then to look at it in what my old friend Roger Fry used to call a state of alert passivity, which is essentially the way the artist looks at the outside world, so that one sees not this analyzed and conceptualized object, but one gets the direct impression of the thing with the minimum of conceptual ideas imposed upon it from inside our skulls.
Does this mean that we're dealing, we'll say, with the flower, with the aesthetics of the flower, or is it something much broader than that?
Well, I think, I mean, on one aspect it's the aesthetics, but it is it's getting as near as possible to what the philosopher Immanuel Kant said was always impossible for us to realize, the thing in itself. I mean, no one has ever seen the thing in itself. But there are degrees of things in their selfness. You can see things almost as they come to us immediately and passively. And then you can see things as we impose our categories upon them. And I think undoubtedly can train ourselves to see more vividly the things as we get them in this state of alert passivity. I mean, it's very important, I think, that we should train ourselves in both fields.
You mentioned the use of this in psychiatric therapy or treatment. Are there other instances where this concept has been used to such
a... Well, for example, in a book which was published, I think, in 1951, a book by three authors, Perls, Hefferlein, and Goodman, called Gestalt Therapy, there are a great many exercises of awareness, of being aware of objects in the outer world, of being aware of, well, of kinesthetic movements, being aware of what it feels like to lift a hand, for example, of being aware of the images going on inside one's head and of one's imagination. And before that, there was for the first 30 years of this century, there was a Swiss doctor, Vitos, who used essentially the same method in treating neurotics with great success in Lausanne. And unfortunately, when he died, the work almost completely disappeared. And you will find similar exercises in direct awareness prescribed in many of the old Oriental texts, above all in the texts of Tantric Buddhism. You will find whole lists of these exercises in awareness, which were regarded as a very valuable training for the final change of consciousness to the state of liberation and enlightenment. So that we have a considerable tradition, I mean, both an old religious tradition and in recent times a certain medical therapeutic tradition of the value of this thing.
Well, you mentioned a while back the kinesthetics of this. We have been talking, I suppose, more of art and of fine art. How does this work with an experience that is kinesthetic rather than one that is purely visual or auditory?
Frankly, I don't exactly know, but for example, in regard to mescaline, this alters, without any doubt, the normal kinesthetic experience. But there are, again, a number of techniques for training people to be aware of their kinesthetic experiences. For example, John Dewey wrote with immense enthusiasm about the method developed by F.M. Alexander for, first of all, becoming aware of kinesthetic experiences, and also for getting into the right postural state, I mean, the proper relationship between the head and neck and the trunk. And Dewey wrote prefaces to three of his books and mentioned the work also in his book on human nature and in the chapter on habit. There is here again a considerable mass of knowledge in regard to this, all of which I think could be applied with great profit to education in general, on every level, from the kindergarten up to death, if you like.
Well, you mentioned just the raising of an arm. What kinds of things could we be aware of in the lifting of an arm?
Well, you can be aware. I mean, there are several ways. I mean, you can sort of lift it carelessly. You can lift it with a deliberate degree of voluntary act. You have it as a fully voluntary act. You can lift it with tension. You can lift it with relaxation. And, I mean, all these things, for example, in regard to a neurotic, are extraordinarily helpful because he goes through life with a frightful unawareness of what is happening here and now. But again, I think quite apart from any therapeutic value, that this increase of awareness is likely to make the world seem more interesting and more enjoyable to people, and I am personally strongly of the belief that boredom and uninterest are one of the main causes of delinquency. I mean, why do people behave, so many behave in such a delinquent way? Because they find the world so frightfully boring that this is the only thing that gives them any kick. Whereas if we did get some pleasure out of looking at a flower or walking along the street or being aware of the motions within our own body, life would be so incomparably more interesting that we shouldn't have to go out and behave as abominably as so many of us do.
We'd be able to see more of the world in a way, then.
Much more of the world, and I would say, too, that this has some value, too, in relation to science. I mean, particularly of the sciences of observation. After all science is ultimately based upon perception. I mean, even the most abstract physical science is based upon the perception of pointer readings, and the moment you get into the field of biology, the direct perception becomes of very great importance, and in ethology, the study of animal behavior, it is absolutely crucial. So that I think even in the limited field of the sciences, this thing can be of very great importance.
But primarily then it's a problem of education, educating the adult to a certain extent recapture this ability that he may have had.
I think so. I mean, I would always use this phrase. The problem is to teach people how to make the best of both worlds. I mean, the rational, conceptual, verbal world, which should certainly we should study with the greatest care, and all, I mean, I think undoubtedly we should have much more education in semantics than we do have, so that we know how to use these words properly and how not to be taken in by them. And at the same time, we should also be taught how to live in a state of alert passivity in regard to external events and in regard to internal events too, so that we do have the possibility of living both here and now and in this abstract world of words.
Thank you very much, Mr. Huxley. We hope that you'll be with us next week at the same time.
I believe that they could be made of anything else but blue fire. For what seemed an immensely long time, I gazed without knowing, even without wishing to know what it was that confronted me. At any other time, I would have seen a chair barred with alternate light and shade. Today, the precept had swallowed up the concept. I was so completely absorbed in looking, so thunderstruck by what I actually saw, that I could not be aware of anything else. It was...
You are watching Your Window to the World, WTEW, Channel 11, Chicago.